Hello, folks, and welcome to this, the first episode of Socratic Citizen of the year of our Lord 2021, here on this dark and cold and rainy Friday. I'm Patrick Cunningham. Let's get the year started. So I promised yesterday that we were going to do uplifting stuff today, because yesterday was very depressing. I thought it was appropriate to end a depressing year on a depressing note, but we're going to start this year on an uplifting note in a kind of quasi-paganistic hope that if we do so, that that will empower us to have a beautiful, wonderful year. But of course, we are talking about politics and culture, and we are talking about the United States of America. So no doubt there's going to be plenty of conflict, plenty of people who are being unreasonable. But you know what? They're Americans. They're our unreasonable, except in one instance. We're going to talk about Canada and, you know, screw those guys because they're not Americans. So let's jump into the first good story that we have today. And it is actually a direct update on a story from yesterday. So it's very convenient that it worked out that way. So yesterday, as I frequently am, I was yelling about the government. And today I have reason to not yell about the government, but to rather speak softly and put down my big stick and say that Reason.com reports that in a last minute reversal, the HHS has voided those Food and Drug Administration fees on distillers who produced emergency hand sanitizer. So it's been a whirlwind 24 hours for American craft distillers, but 2020 is ending with some good news. Thanks to some media coverage, including here at Reason, of an unexpected and substantial fee imposed by the Food and Drug Administration on distillers who pivoted to produce much-needed hand sanitizer, the federal government has reversed course on what would have been a devastating blow to small businesses. So for those who weren't here yesterday, a number of distilleries, specifically one called Calwise out in California, Paso Robles, they switched from producing spirits, which they normally do, to producing hand sanitizer, the active ingredient in which is alcohol, which these folks are already quite good at making. But then the FDA stepped in and they said, look, if you want to make hand sanitizer, you got to make sure the alcohol is denatured just in case someone wants to try and drink the hand sanitizer. Heaven forbid in a pandemic someone accidentally get a hold of some alcohol in the quest to sanitize their hands. And then recently sent out letters to all of these distilleries saying, by the way, you owe us $14,000 in fees to fund FDA regulatory activities, as it says right here, a fee of more than $14,000 as over-the-counter drug production facilities to cover the costs of FDA regulation. But late today, however, this is the key part of the article, the Department of Health and Human Services reversed the policy. In a statement posted to Twitter, the HHS Chief of Staff Brian Harrison said, quote, small businesses who stepped up to fight COVID-19 should be applauded by their government, not taxed for doing so. I'm pleased to announce we have directed FDA to cease enforcement of these arbitrary and surprise user fees. Happy New Year, distilleries, and cheers to you for helping to keep us safe. So yes, thank you very much, distilleries, for stepping up in the moment of America's dire need. And as an act of gratitude, we're not going to charge you government fees. So thank you, federal government, for not being the biggest jerks that you possibly could be, which I know is kind of the default thing for a lot of government agencies. But anyway, so I want to move on and talk about some of the hilarious and interesting stories that are kind of like out there in the world before we talk about the more serious stuff. Because like I said, if you're going to talk about America, you're going to be talking about conflict. So let's talk about the Canadians. And I don't mean people who don't tip in restaurants. Those who have worked in the restaurant industry will know what I'm talking about. But the Post Millennial reports that Toronto has ramped up efforts to stop illegal hockey and tobogganing. Canada has a lot of big problems lately. Apparently, one of them is illegal hockey. So the city of Toronto is cracking down on residents who illegally use city ice rinks and illegally toboggan on city ski and snowboarding hills. Only in Canada, I have to say, could you have an actual news article about an actual government program to crack down on illegal tobogganing. I mean, maybe in Maine, we would have that here in the United States, but we've got bigger problems here. Maybe it's nice to live in a country where your biggest problem is people illegally using tobogganing slopes. But the Toronto Sun reported that the city's emergency management head, Matthew Pegg, Wednesday at a city press briefing cautioned that paid duty police and municipal security officers will increase patrols at the city's 54 outdoor skating rinks and illegal tobogganing on city ski and snowboarding hills. Since December 23rd, Toronto police have charged 19 people under the Trespass to Property Act for illegal acts of hockey on city-owned ice. Really, the whole reason I wanted to talk about this story was this phrase right here. Illegal acts of hockey. Only in Canada, folks. Even in Russia, they don't have such things because Russia has real problems. Illegally consuming several gallons of vodka at a single sitting, for example. But I don't want to spend all day on that because, of course, we need to talk about real stories that affect real people here in the United States. And so I want to take a look at this here, which is from American Military News. And this is a report that China offered bounties to attack U.S. troops in Afghanistan, says intelligence, and Trump plans to declassify it. Well, would you look at that? Donald Trump fighting for America and Murica and patriotism and the military and so on and so forth. Things are, of course, not always what they seem here. Let's read a little bit of this and then see what's actually going on. So U.S. Marines patrolling in Helmand Province, Afghanistan. That's a caption. Don't listen to me. Well, do listen to me, just not that part. So two senior administration officials close to President Donald Trump told Axios on Wednesday that the president recently received an intelligence briefing with not yet corroborated claims China offered bounties to attack U.S. troops in Afghanistan, and he plans to declassify that intelligence soon. The officials said National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien briefed Trump on the preliminary intelligence on December 17th. Axios reported they did not receive any intelligence documents, but an intelligence summary was described to them in a phone call with administration officials. Quote, the U.S. has evidence that the People's Republic of China attempted to finance attacks on American servicemen by Afghan non-state actors by offering financial incentives or bounties, one official said, adding that the National Security Council, quote, is coordinating a whole-of-government investigation to investigate the allegations. This story sounds familiar, does it not? Have we not heard this very story? Did we not hear this very story during the presidential debates, the second round of presidential debates? Joe Biden brought up this story, but sub in the word Russia for the word China. He said, Donald Trump, you knew that Russia was paying bounties on dead American soldiers in Afghanistan and you did nothing about it. And that story, we were all very happy to say, was a complete hoax. There was actually no real intelligence suggesting that Russia had was willing to pay money for dead American soldiers. And reasonable people, of course, even before the story was shown to be false, were scratching their heads and saying, can this really be true? What does Russia stand to gain from dead American soldiers? That doesn't seem to make much sense. We're not at war with Russia, despite what the neoconservative wing of the Republican Party and the neoliberal wing of the Democratic Party seem to wish for in the dark of night when no one's around to hear them speaking their real thoughts. We're not at war with Russia, nor should we be at war with Russia. They're not the Soviet Union anymore. They're not threatening us. What they are really is trying to establish themselves as a regional hegemon. They want regional influence. And American foreign policy's unstated objective is to prevent the emergence of regional hegemonies as a way to ensure American full-spectrum dominance, to borrow parlance from the Bush administration's Undersecretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz. Those of you who are old enough to remember the Bush administration, I just barely am. But anyway, So now we have the exact same story as came out a few months ago, but now it's China. And this represents, I think, a real current in American politics, and I've seen other people say it, so I can't really claim a lot of originality on this story. But frankly, the Republicans are trying to convince you that China is our enemy. The Democrats are trying to convince you that Russia is our enemy. When in reality, we're not at war with either of these countries. They don't really threaten the United States or Americans, except for soldiers threatened stationed in bases abroad, if even that. What they really do is they threaten American world dominance. And so if you are of that intellectual bent that says the United States has a responsibility to enforce its dominance around the world as a way to like prevent World War III, then yes, Russia or China may be threats, and we can sit here and have a left-right discussion and stroke our beards and congratulate ourselves and our geopolitical wisdom for destroying our opponents when it comes to convincing them that Russia and or China are the greatest threat to American dominance worldwide. Or, like me, you could look back to the proud American tradition of isolationism with a kind of forlorn hope that perhaps we can just let Russia and China do their thing, and that maybe the American military could, for a change, be used to defend American interests. That indeed, if we were to do so, we might not need $800 billion for the military budget, and we could cut some of that money out and maybe send Americans $2,000 checks here in the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression and the worst pandemic since the 1918 Spanish influenza catastrophe. But unfortunately, no, we have to continue to fund American imperial adventurism abroad, and that means that we have to watch out for the rise of China and or the rise of Russia. And just to keep the people in line, we have to have stories like this. Maybe there is real intelligence, maybe I'm completely wrong about all of this, but the real point still stands, that it's only American imperialism that is threatened by China. China will not be invading San Francisco anytime soon. Russia will not be landing troops in Alaska anytime soon. Sarah Palin can sit there keeping vigil with her shotgun on the western coast of Alaska. She will not see any Russian troop transports coming anytime soon. So, of course, that does not mean, however, that we can expect good things from the Biden administration. The end of Trump will not mean the end of a blundering American imperialism abroad. Speaking loudly, carrying a big stick, and swinging it around like a bull in a china shop will continue, if not get worse, under the Biden administration. Because where Trump would stand up at press conferences and yell and berate reporters and tell them that they were fake news and destroying America, all very annoying practices, no doubt, especially for the reporters involved, Biden has his own unique way of going after the press, or rather, perhaps his handlers have their own unique way of going after the press. And Ben Shapiro's rag, The Daily Wire, is only too happy to report that the Biden team has disabled chat on virtual press conferences after reporters ask tough questions. The tough questions part is a little questionable. Actually, they didn't really ask tough questions. As we'll see when we read this, what they really asked was, why can't we ask questions? And if asking questions about asking questions is the best you can do when it comes to asking tough questions, you may need to go back to journalism school, folks. Or maybe you need to learn a little bit from the intrepid 19th century reporters who produced the first, among others, the socialist movement in the United States, back when it wasn't cool to be a socialist, back when it was actually difficult. And you got people like Eugene Debs. But anyway, I don't want to launch into a discussion about 19th century socialist revolutionaries. What I want to talk about is this. Democrat Joe Biden's White House transition team has reportedly disabled the chat function on their Zoom virtual press conferences after invited journalists began complaining about the group's lack of transparency. So you had we're seeing how the Biden administration is going to treat the press relative to how the Trump administration treated the press. Like I said, Donald Trump, he would berate reporters. He would yell at them. Starting with Sean Spicer, he had a long series of press secretaries who would yell at the press and argue with the press and berate the press and insult the press. Biden just shuts them down, or Biden's team just shuts them down. I think that we're going to see, as Biden takes office, a shift of focus away from the person of the president and an increasing focus on the president's team, his handlers, if you will, depending on how you feel about old Sleepy Joe there. So as the Daily Wire reported, reporters were becoming frustrated with the Biden team and with Biden himself because the team appeared to have a slate of favored journalists who were always called on to ask questions during the team's virtual press conferences. And it's the predictable list: the New York Times, CNN, the Washington Post, PBS, and Politico were given the opportunity to ask questions of the team at nearly every press conference, while even mainstream media outlets like the Associated Press were shut out. Now, you know, you've seen the videos of Biden getting asked questions he doesn't want to answer. Trump has a tendency to walk away or kind of passive-aggressively ignore reporters who ask questions he doesn't like. And you've seen Biden actually start, like, berating the reporters as well. So that's why, again, I say this is coming more from his team than it is from Biden himself. Biden has a little bit of a history of getting mad at people, of yelling at people, and telling people, getting angry and saying, well, why don't you just go vote for Trump then? Come on, man. So not a lot of good... not a lot of good portents here for the press transparency of the office of the American president. And of course, we see what the American government does to real journalists, journalists who do more than ask tough questions, who actually expose really embarrassing stuff for the United States. And this policy, unless Donald Trump surprises everyone, especially me, by pardoning Julian Assange and Edward Snowden before he leaves office, we can really say with confidence that the attitude of the federal government as a whole, of the executive branch as a whole toward the press, remains consistent through the Trump, the Obama, and the Biden administrations, because the Assange extradition decision, as the World Socialist website, that's literally Leon Trotsky's magazine from 1917, but it's turned into a website now. So his extradition decision is due on January 4th. So next, or actually on Monday, we will be finding out what happens to Julian Assange. And they say mobilize the working class to secure his freedom. So the UK courts will decide on Monday, January 4th, whether WikiLeaks founder and journalist Julian Assange should be extradited to the United States. He faces a life sentence on charges under the Espionage Act for exposing war crimes and coup plots, torture, and other human rights abuses, state corruption, and spying. So a decision to extradite is all but assured. The hearing was a pseudo-legal travesty which saw Assange's basic democratic rights trampled. Presiding District Judge Vanessa Bereitzer has treated Assange with undisguised hostility throughout the proceedings. Her supervisor, Lady Emma Arbuthnot, is married to a government figure named personally in the WikiLeaks exposures. And this, of course, is a testament to a degree of fairness and justice accorded to people who really do scare the powers that be. You know, if there's really any threat to the power structures that undergird and overgird our society, you see these pretensions of recusal, of fairness in trials kind of go out the window, because we got to get this guy right here with the thistle down hair. And it really doesn't matter his rights. In fact, the more of his rights you can take away, the better off you'll be as a government. And a decision either way, as the article says, will be met with an appeal leading to months or even years more legal battles. All the while, Assange will be kept imprisoned in Belmarsh maximum security prison in London at great risk to his life. We talked about this a few weeks ago, maybe a couple months ago now, but as it turns out, a couple of psychiatrists who have evaluated Julian Assange say he is on the verge of committing suicide at this point. And I believe at one point during his stay in the Ecuadorian embassy, razor blades were found in his room, suggesting that he might have been close to getting up to something a little dangerous. And one has to wonder, you know, and I don't know, this isn't really political commentary at this point, I'm just curious. I wonder if it ever occurred to him when he started WikiLeaks that things might turn out this way? Was he more like the 18-year-old soldier who goes charging into enemy fire, who we accuse, not accuse, who we think of as more perhaps naive than really evincing the kind of courage that recognizes the danger? Was Julian Assange a foolhardy individual? Was he someone who was naive about what the results of exposing government secrets would be? Or did he perhaps recognize that this is how it might all turn out and decide to do it anyway? I know those who wax a little bit worshipful of him. He represents a kind of folk hero to journalists and to people like me, frankly. And so the tendency is to lionize such a person and say he knew exactly what he was getting into and he just did it anyway. But I know in my own life that many times when I make decisions or I do things, I think about the possible long-term consequences of them. But it's hard for me to picture doing anything that could result in what's happened to Assange. He's kept in a cage at the back of the courtroom, a plastic cage. Generally, that kind of treatment is reserved for people who are in danger of like attacking other people in the courtroom. But Julian Assange is a computer nerd, not a serial killer, but he's been treated like the most dangerous of serial killers. And so you see this, you can see looking at this, looking at the story about Biden, you can see a kind of emerging pattern when it comes to the American government and the British government, when it comes to treating journalists. If you're a safe journalist, you might just get shut down and not listened to. If you're a real journalist, a dangerous journalist, they will really throw the book at you. But we're not here to just talk about Julian Assange because, of course, as we know, they will be counting the electoral votes in Congress here next week on Wednesday. And a number of representatives and several senators now, or at least one senator, has said, Josh Hawley has said that he will contest those results. And of course, this sounds like a great threat to democracy and the first time anything like this has ever happened, but it's actually not the case. As it turns out, these challenges to the Electoral College count occurred both in 2016 and in 2004. So Fox News reports this, but we're going to look at two stories here in conjunction. So the first story is Fox News calling out the Democrats. Fox News is desperate to get back all the Trump supporters that abandoned them in the wake of the 2020 election, because I think their advertising rates are going to have to be adjusted downward in the wake of those destroyed ratings. So you see Fox News trying to pander a little bit to the Trump people, saying Democrats who praised the 2004 objections to the Electoral College certification now slam Hawley. So Senator Josh Hawley sparked outrage Wednesday with his decision to object to the certification of certain states' electoral college votes, including, by the way, my state, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania. Anyway, during Congress's joint session on January 6th, joining several House members who have also said they will object to force a vote in each the House and Senate over whether to accept individual slates, of electors. Quote, the political equivalent of barking at the moon, Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, said of Hawley joining the challenge to electoral slates. This won't be taken seriously, and nor should it be. The American people made a decision on November 3rd, and that decision must and will be honored and protected by the United States Senate and House of Representatives. And the challenge is almost certain to fail, as indeed the challenges by Democrats in 2016 and 2004 failed. But even though Fox News is like, oh, look, we caught Democrats being hypocrites. Hooray, we're going to get some ratings. I think that ultimately, as U.S. News reports here, this guy is right when he says this. When Ben Sasse says the GOP's meddling with Electoral College vote is just a bid for Trump supporters. Because the big lesson from the last couple of months has been, if you don't give the Trump supporters what they want, they will abandon you. They are crazy and they are aggressive, and you can't just keep them quiet. You can't give them dog treats and put them in the kennel anymore. They're just not going to put up with it. So for better or for worse, the Trump lunatics, and I say that lovingly, my wonderful Trump lunatics, who I love so much through all of their lunacy, and even sometimes because of their lunacy, have become a major force to be reckoned with, not just in the Republican Party, but in American politics in general. So on the last day of President Donald Trump's last full year in office, a conservative Republican senator delivered a blunt message to his colleagues and to his red state constituents, clinging to hopes that Trump could stay in office despite having lost by 7 million votes. There's nothing there. Senator Ben Sasse, a conservative Nebraska Republican who has voted overwhelmingly for Trump's agenda but has separated from the president himself, penned a lengthy and detailed post on his Facebook page spelling out why Joe Biden won the election and why it's foolish to try and challenge those results. But of course, the Trump people are not listening. They're not going to go along with this. They're going to keep fighting, and they will turn to increasingly conspiratorial and off the mainstream websites and news sources if it supports their preferred narrative that Donald Trump is just one good move away from retaking the presidency and being sworn in on January 20th. Though I stand with Ben Sasse in saying that's not going to happen, these challenges are purely performative. I mean, hey, if you want to go through performative challenges, that's fine. Democrats who say this is some kind of threat to democracy are very confused, or they're just being hypocritical. Those who are inclined to kind of go, okay, this is doomed to fail, why do we have to go through this, who express primarily exasperation with the process, that would be most in line with my opinion. So the Trump people are, of course, as I've said, going a little nuts, and perhaps the poster boy for this nuts going is, as the Daily Beast reports here, Trumpist lawyer Lynn Wood. I don't know where they found this guy, and I would encourage Kyle Rittenhouse to fire him if Kyle Rittenhouse wants any chance at anything like a real trial, because Lynn Wood has shown himself to be a true loose cannon with this. Lynn Wood casually suggests that Chief Justice Roberts is a murderous pedophile. And this is one of several accusations thrown by Lynn Wood that we're going to take a look at here. So pro-Trump lawyer Lynn Wood ramped up the crazy on Wednesday night by suggesting Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts was somehow involved in Justice Antonin Scalia's death and part of a child sex cult. Did we not bring this up a few days ago? Were we not talking about, I told you, somebody sent me an article alleging that the CIA had compromised Chief Justice John Roberts by whatever, filming him having sex with children and using that to blackmail him into refusing any and all suits brought before the Supreme Court alleging election fraud, because the CIA is engaging in a concerted effort to blackmail sex offenders in the highest levels of government into getting rid of Donald Trump. All of it smacks of QAnon, frankly. I think this is all, you could call this like derivative QAnon stuff. So Wood, alongside on-again, off-again Trump campaign lawyer Sidney Powell, has been at the forefront of President Donald Trump's hopeless attempt to overturn President-elect Joe Biden's decisive victory in the November 3rd election. So let me be clear. I'm not saying that there was nothing untoward in the November elections. I'm not saying that Biden's team didn't cheat. I'm not saying any of that. I'm saying trying to challenge it now is a lost cause. It's not going to work. But Lynn Wood has not only said it can work, it's going to work. He said we should boycott the Senate runoff elections here in Georgia. In fact, if the Democrats win, if John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock end up in the United States Senate, if the Democrats have de facto control of all three branches, or excuse me, of both houses of Congress and of the presidency come the end of January, I think it's a safe bet to say that of all the people involved, Lynn Wood will specifically and personally be to blame, and that ultimately he should bear some responsibility for any craziness that happens as a result of having a de facto one-party government for at least the next 2 years. So besides filing a slew of conspiratorial lawsuits alleging election fraud that have been laughed out of court, I don't know if they've been laughed out of court. They have not been able to get past the initial hearing phase. So Wood has urged, here it is, Georgian Republicans not to vote in next week's pivotal Senate runoffs because of his belief that the election will be, quote, rigged, and has filed an emergency petition with the Supreme Court to halt the January 5th election. Now, I know that the Republican Party has doubled the number of poll watchers that they will be using in this election here and vote count watchers. So we'll see what happens in the Georgia runoff elections here. I think that a Republican win will be a big blow against the idea that there was fraud, at least in Georgia. I can't speak to Michigan or Pennsylvania. I don't really know what went on there. I don't think many people do really know what happened in this election. It's the sort of thing we're not going to know the real answer until about 100 years from now. So come back in 100 years and we'll have the exclusive footage and the exclusive scoop on what really went down in the November 2020 elections. But of course, Lynn Wood did not stop there. And the liberals at Raw Story are just very pleased with themselves to be able to report that Trump fans freak out after attorney Lynn Wood claims Jeffrey Epstein is alive. Well, that's interesting. So we had Jeffrey Epstein didn't kill himself, and now we've moved to Jeffrey Epstein isn't dead. I was a little sympathetic to Jeffrey Epstein didn't kill himself, suggesting either that some enterprising gang members decided to sneak into his cell and kill him just for being a child molester, because that's the sort of thing that goes on in America's prisons, or perhaps that somebody knew something, or somebody knew that Mr. Epstein knew something that they didn't want to get out and maybe signed up to get rid of him. But I don't think that he's alive. I think that's a little silly. But Lynn Wood, as the story says, an attorney attempting to help Donald Trump dispute the election returns in Georgia, set off a flurry of controversy on Wednesday night after he tried to implicate Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts in the death of late Justice Antonin Scalia, as we talked about, and then suggested that Roberts' two children were adopted with the help of Jeffrey Epstein. Thursday morning, yesterday, the attorney doubled down and claimed that Epstein, who died under mysterious circumstances in a New York City jail, was still alive. So, Wood tweets, "I'm fully aware of the onslaught of attacks being made against me." Wow, a surprise. Are you surprised that people are attacking you, saying that Chief Justice John Roberts is a secret pedophile who's been compromised by the CIA and Jeffrey Epstein is alive? So, I can only hope. I can only cross my fingers and say that he's going to double down and triple down and quadruple down on claims like these and continue to make more claims like these until he just vanishes into irrelevance, because I don't think he's helping anyone except maybe his Twitter following. He's getting some good like mentions in the press here, but he has really stretched the wisdom of the old adage that bad publicity is good publicity, because at this point, the bad publicity is so bad from saying that the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court is a hostage of the CIA because of his secret pedophilia and that Jeffrey Epstein is alive somewhere. I imagine that Jeffrey Epstein is hanging out with Hitler and Elvis and Bigfoot on a UFO somewhere, but I can only hope that Mr. Lynn Woods here ends up in like irrelevance as a result of saying crazy things like this. But the Trump people are still motivated. They are still enthusiastic. There is still a lot coming out of this. So we have here a story from the Independent that Trump backing anti-maskers storm a California shop saying, "I don't want underwear over my face." I would be inclined to agree that I don't want underwear over my face, but I think masks only count as underwear if you're also wrapped in a scarf, because then that counts as the overwear. But this comes in a long string of stories that we've been talking about over the past couple of days and weeks about the American people and the British people, by the way, becoming increasingly sick of lockdown measures and becoming increasingly unwilling to quote-unquote, listen to the science, to the extent that the science informs the lockdowns and mask mandates, and have indeed started rebelling in real ways. It's becoming increasingly difficult to convince people that there is any benefit to still wearing masks. So a crowd of around 50, to read the article here, maskless people stormed into a grocery store in California flouting safety guidelines in what they said was a protest against mask restrictions getting, quote, out of hand. I have to say, this kind of stuff goes on in California. This kind of stuff, I have heard zero stories of anything like this happening in my home state of Georgia, because Georgia has been extremely reasonable about lockdown measures and about masks. Generally, most stores that have lots of people in them say, please wear a mask if you want to come in here. I mean, obviously, they don't make you wear masks in restaurants, but things are largely open. Nothing's really closed down. Some establishments have chosen to close down. Some localities, I know that the Sandy Springs municipality, a little ways away from here, over on the north side of Atlanta, has a local mask mandate. But in general, not a lot has changed here. Georgia has not experienced tremendously bad COVID results. We're not like leading the nation in terms of deaths or infections or anything. By and large, the Georgia government did a pretty good job, and you're not seeing anything like this. You're not seeing the Atlanta police called in the way the Los Angeles police here were called into the grocery store in Erewhon Market in the Fairfax District. Props and points, and I'll send you $5 if you know what Erewhon Market is referencing. That is hilarious. Only in California. So after the crowd began aggressively questioning the store's employees and customers, according to a report by KTLA TV, and only in California would you have Los Angeles police called out because people are aggressively questioning a store's employees. So the police said the crowd was protesting safety guidelines, by either taking off their masks inside the store or entering without a face covering. And of course, we have all seen Kurt Eichenwald, or as he's known on Twitter, Kurt Mask Save Lives Eichenwald, who said, I'd like to find a anti-masker and beat them to death. Since they seem to think it's okay to kill other people, certainly they can't protest if I do so. Make of that what you will, I don't see Kurt Eichenwald wandering into this particular crowd as the protesters are heard chanting slogans like, open up LA. One person yelled, they want you to wear a mask, they want you to lock down. I don't know if this is really a protest, it's more of just a statement of fact. Yes, sir, they do want you to wear a mask and want you to lock down. I think that's really the starting point of any discussion here, is we have to acknowledge what the reality of the situation is, and that is indeed the reality of the situation. So props to you for starting the philosophical discussion in the proper place. A bystander, the article says, Ira Brian Miller, posted the video of the crowd chanting and aggressively pushing people in order to enter the store. Speaking to the LA Times, Mr. Miller, a resident of West Hollywood, said the crowd was pushing their way in. They were trying to push the workers out of the way for them to enter the store, said Mr. Miller. He also said he heard protesters asking people to take off their masks. And a woman who was part of the protest wearing a red MAGA hat told the Daily Beast, the masks do nothing. That's why you can wear anything. I don't want underwear over my face. I'll pull off my underwear right now and put them over my face. Not sure what that last part is about. I definitely recommend that she does not do that. I don't think that's going to do anything except subject you to a rather unpleasant smell and create a look that I don't think anyone wants to see from you. But in England, similar things are taking place. As the Daily Mail reports, an anti-lockdown activist is arrested over, quote, secret hospital footage. This one gets a little weird and a little creepy. When you start arresting people for stuff like this, I become concerned. And I did my best to kind of debunk this story before talking about it. To go, oh, this must not be the full thing. But no, it appears that this is really what happened. So an anti-lockdown protester and comrade of Jeremy Corbyn's anti-vaxxer brother Piers has been arrested for filming inside a hospital and sharing footage on social media she claims shows the coronavirus pandemic is, quote, a massive scam. Now, while I don't want to go in for these kind of pronouncements here, I'm not just going to go, oh, it's a scam, it's all made up. I don't know about that. That seems a little extreme. However, I do think it's good to point out that not every single hospital is completely overwhelmed, that the idea that the hospital system is just, you know, falling apart under the weight of all the COVID patients is not a completely true narrative. And remember, cui bono, who benefits? The news media, especially now that Trump is leaving office and they won't have him as a kind of bugbear used to gin up their ratings, have to go back to turning everything into the worst possible catastrophe. The news media has a vested interest in you thinking that the coronavirus is the end of the world, because when people think the world is ending, guess what? They watch the news. And the more they watch the news, the more money the news media makes. So while this lady no doubt has the same motivation to try and turn everything into the biggest possible scam, oh my God, COVID's not even real, right? Because then she gets views, she gets retweets, she gets attention, she gets her 5 minutes of fame. The news media telling you that the hospital system is falling apart are just as motivated in the opposite direction. But anyway, Debbie Hicks wandered around Gloucester. I don't remember which one. But anyway, Royal Hospital on Monday saying it was, quote, shut down and dead, and was arrested in her dressing gown by two officers who visited her home in Stroud 24 hours later. In the 8-minute film viewed by 158,000 people on Facebook, she says, we've been put in tier 3 for this. It's a disgrace. I've seen less than 20 people. It's completely dead in an empty hospital with wards shut down and the lights off. Where are all the people dying and where is the mutant virus? I can't see the evidence and neither can the public watching. We've been robbed of Christmas for this. Now, Gloucester Royal Hospital hit back and insisted the wards were extremely busy and accused her of intrusion and upsetting patients filmed waiting in A&E. One doctor told Mail Online she had filmed a deserted outpatient area on a bank holiday Monday, hence why it was empty. And so the real story to take away from this here, the story that the idea that the hospitals are just completely falling apart is not correct. But the story that there's no one in the hospital and COVID's not even real is also incorrect. The real story, as usual, is somewhere in the middle. And only by maintaining the kind of disinterested distance of the true scientist and philosopher can we ever ascertain the real truth. And that's why you guys have me to ascertain the real truth and tell you about it in hilarious commentary form. So we need to pivot from COVID to the various other kinds of protests, to the various other kinds of things. And COVID and also the so-called racial reckoning in the United States has led to a long series of protests, violent encounters, a rise in the crime rate in the big cities in the United States, especially as they increasingly defund their police departments. It's all very confusing and it's not clear who is right, who is wrong, and as usual, the truth is somewhere in the middle. So the Daily Caller reports that protests follow a police shooting of a felony suspect in Minneapolis. A man was fatally shot by Minneapolis police after a traffic stop turned into an exchange of gunfire Wednesday evening near a gas station in Minneapolis, according to law enforcement officials. A felony suspect who was pulled over during a traffic stop opened fire on police officers, according to witness statements. Minneapolis Police Chief Madaria Arredondo said, that's a great name, Madaria Arredondo. Sounds like a song. But anyway, said in a press conference on Wednesday, the subject was fatally shot by police, but no other injuries were reported. Now, as far as we can tell, the police department is releasing the body camera footage. The police department says the felony suspect opened fire on police officers first, and police officers shot back, eventually killing him. And they have tried to calm everyone down and say, look, guys, just you can protest. We're going to protect your First Amendment rights. Please don't throw things at the officers. Please do not throw ice chunks at the officers right here. Specifically, he asked for the demonstrators not to throw rocks, bottles, or ice chunks at officers. That sounds very unpleasant. So Minneapolis police reportedly asked over a scanner to use chemical irritants on protesters, that would be tear gas, to disperse the crowd. Washington Post reporter Holly Bailey tweeted, officers then asked to use less lethal rounds, I think rubber bullets maybe, to respond to protesters throwing ice balls, but a supervisor declined both requests. So this seems like a pretty up-and-up handling of this situation. This looks like things went relatively the way you would hope that they would go. But let's not forget that Minnesota was one of the places who had various municipalities defunding their police. One of the other municipalities that decided to do some police defunding was New York. And New York has not seen good things as a result. Because on the one hand, you have the idea that police engage in brutality. And I'm not here to question that. If you're tuning into this show because you think that I'm like, I back the blue and the police are always right, you've tuned in to the wrong show. We're not here to say that. I am here to say that the police do perform important functions in society, and you have to hold on to the police force. You can't just get rid of the police. That's a bad idea, especially if you have nothing really to replace them. I would be all for having local militias enforce many of the laws. That would be very cool. However, that does not exist. And so unless you're willing to let American citizens start carrying police gear all the time and keeping it in their homes, which I don't think many of these progressives are willing to do, then you got to hold on to the police. You have to have something enforcing the law. We cannot live in the fantasy world where if you take away the police, that suddenly everyone will embrace their inner hippie and we will all hold hands and sing kumbaya in violation of traffic laws. That's not what's going to happen. You're going to see opportunists take advantage of the defunding of the police to engage in crime. We are one of the more high crime, high policing, high incarceration rate societies in the world. As I like to say, we're only a partially civilized nation. In some ways, that's endearing. I love our partially civilized status as a nation, but at the same time, we should be cognizant of what that means in terms of policy. It means that if you do start willy-nilly defunding police departments, you get stuff like this. A gang of 50 teens, as the Daily Mail reports, smash up an SUV in a brazen daylight attack on New York's Fifth Avenue. This is not the only car that they attacked. They also went after, I believe, a yellow taxi. But an SUV driver and his mother say they thought they were going to be killed after a gang of teenagers surrounded their car and began smashing it up in New York City, actually on Fifth Avenue. So the shocking incident occurred in broad daylight in the heart of Manhattan on Tuesday. Evidence that Big Apple officials are failing to protect residents amid surging rates of violent crime. The reason they're failing to protect residents is because not just that police departments have been defunded, but also because of the attitude of the defund the police zeitgeist in which we currently exist. The idea that any strong police crackdown of anything on anyone for any reason will be met with strong resistance and perhaps violent protests. So we are in a very touchy situation right now, and I think that turning this into a black people versus the police war is the best way to make sure that nothing good gets done. If we could have a reasonable discussion about this, then we might actually be able to reform policing in such a way that it helps everyone. But people have turned it into a race issue, and they've turned it into a kind of like social warfare kind of issue, which is the best way to bring out all of the worst instincts that live in the murdering, raping, hooting baboon that inhabits this very well coiffed form of mine and also inhabits the forms of all other humans in the world. And as long as we're operating on the baboon level of thinking, we're going to get baboon level results. And you know how baboons interact with each other. To quote the great Dr. Robert Sapolsky, male baboons don't groom each other. They rip each other's faces off. And I think that's what you start to see here whenever we start to have police crackdowns in these liberal cities. So Max Torgovnik, who's 36, was driving in the BMW with his mom when they encountered the large group of youngsters biking up Fifth Avenue near 21st Street. So the pair had just dropped off a holiday donation to a local charity when their vehicle was viciously set upon. BS Artist says baboons are awesomely violent. Yes, they are. That is exactly the point I am making. So we don't want to operate on a baboon level of thinking because humans have a little bit of a baboon nature. I know baboons are not our closest relatives, but you get the point that left to our own devices, if we start operating on that kind of tribal lower level brain, that we start to act that way. And before you know it, we're like lynching people in the town square. We've seen it before. It happened in the Deep South in the United States history. It also happened to Mussolini when order broke down in Italy toward the end of World War II there. So we don't want to see that. We don't want to turn into baboons. We want to be civilized. And so I think, yeah, honestly, this story in and of itself seems to be an instance of people descending to a baboon level of thinking. So according to eyewitnesses, the teens began blocking traffic and started to attack the luxury car. So shocking video shows several teens punching the BMW's windows and stomping on its hood. A woman says she thought she was going to be killed. Something's wrong with this article. We're like back at the beginning of the article now. Anyway, Daily Mail needs to hire more editors. But the good news is, as Fox News reports, they did manage to arrest at least one person involved in this attack. I think that they're on their way to find the rest of them. There's no doubt this 15-year-old will be rolling on his friends, I'm sure. He's been arrested in connection with the wild Tuesday attack of a BMW driver whose posh car was vandalized by a bicycle gang in broad daylight in Manhattan, the Post has learned. The teen from Queens, who's not being identified because he's a minor, is being charged as a juvenile after allegedly attacking victim Max Torgovnik's luxury ride on Fifth Avenue, law enforcement's four sources said on Wednesday. And I love this sentence. The sources said approximately 25 bikers were involved, six of which damaged Torgovnik's car. Teenage bikers, not on motorcycles, but on bikes. Artist says, you reckon those teens have dads they fear? Do they know the sound of the belt being pulled out of those belt loops? I honestly don't know. I do know that the United States leads the world. We talked about this on the show, that there's a Pew Research study. It says the United States leads the world in single parenthood. We have the highest rate on the planet of single parenthood. And there are actually studies that link that statistic to statistics around mass incarceration in the United States, that the reason we have the police force that we have, the reason we have the incarceration rates that we do, is because we have the single parenthood rates that we do. So if I was a betting man, which I'm generally not, because, you know, gambling is, my father would beat me with a belt when he caught me gambling. That's a joke. My father did not beat me. But point being, I would be inclined to agree with the thrust of your argument that generally kids who come from single parent homes, they suffer really a bum deal because they're more likely to end up in jail, less likely to graduate high school or college. It's really not good. The weird thing is, though, I don't want to get too much on a tangent, but a weird thing is that the children of widows and widowers do not seem to be affected by single parenthood the way the children of divorced parents do. It's very strange, and I don't really know what accounts for that, but it does appear to be the case that if you have one of the parents die rather than divorce away or separate away, that you seem to, the kids who grow up in those homes still seem to have the benefits accrued to them that two-parent households have. So the Western Journal reports, as long as we're talking about protests and violence and baboon-level thinking, says it looks like eco-terrorists hit gas lines in a coordinated attack as thousands are left with no heat in single-digit temperatures. So radical environmental activists, apparently, it's not known for sure, but engaged in a supposedly an coordinated attack on gas lines, which left thousands without heat during one of the coldest times of the year. And it seems that the alleged eco-terrorists who may have been behind the act, and then we get some kind of opinionizing there. So here we go. According to ABC News, Black Hills Energy gas lines in Aspen, Colorado, were hit as part of an apparent coordinated attack Saturday night. As of Tuesday, thousands of residents were still without gas heat as temperatures approached 0 degrees Fahrenheit. Although the city and Black Hills Energy were working diligently to fix the issue, an estimated one-third of affected customers went into Wednesday with no service. They tampered with flow lines, Aspen Assistant Police Chief Bill Lynn said. So this is just another one. The only really reason I bring this up is this is just another instance of the same sort of thing we've been seeing throughout the country, which is the kind of breakdown of trust, an increase in chaos in general, and it's really starting to look like the 1960s all over again, especially when you see things like this. We talked about how things on both sides of the Atlantic seem to be mirroring each other, and so it's very unsurprising to see the Daily Mail report that a couple was arrested for attacking three police officers after they were stopped not wearing masks. But I want to touch on something real quick here because I've only got a couple of minutes left. But you've probably all heard the story of the woman who outed Hilaria Baldwin, or Hilaria Baldwin. I don't know how you're supposed to say the name. It's not her real name. As it turns out, Alex Baldwin's Spanish wife is not Spanish. She was born in Boston, and she's actually just a white person, but she was pretending to be Spanish. Now, I don't know whether Alec Baldwin knew about this or not. Was she pretending with him, or was he in on the whole I'm a fake Spanish person? But it's, as you can see here, page 6 of the New York Post reports, the woman who outed Hilaria Baldwin says the fake Spanish accent is offensive. And of course, she's kind of being lumped in with the Rachel Dolezals of the world, like, oh, she's pretending to be some race that she's not. When, first of all, Spain is in Europe. Spanish people are European Americans. They are indeed part of the oppressor class, unfortunately, insofar as such a thing exists. But anyway, I just want to say, as a kind of little comment on this whole story, this story is dumb. I don't care at all whether if she wants to pretend to be Spanish, she can pretend to be Spanish. It's not offensive. It's just a thing. I mean, people dress up as cartoon characters and have sex with each other. So if I want to pretend that I'm from a country I'm not from, that's really not a big deal. It doesn't matter at all. Only in the bizarro world of 2020 could that have mattered. And here's hoping that the world of 2021 can be more of a regular world and less of a bizarro world. And we can live in a world where if someone wants to just do something weird, like pretend they're from a different country, then we'll just shrug our shoulders and say, okay, whatever you want. It really, no one's life is affected by this. Least of all this woman who outed her. I mean, this is like just busybodiness on a tremendous level. And it just makes It makes me worse to have to read about this. It makes the country worse that we think that this is some kind of real issue. It's not an issue. It doesn't matter. If she wants to be Spanish, let her be Spanish. Who cares? So I promised you uplifting material, but the uplifting material has to come couched in something that seems not uplifting. So let's take a look at this. It's from the World Socialist website, my favorite socialist rag, and it says, racialist campaign in Boston culminates in the removal of a statue of Lincoln and an emancipated slave. So the World Socialist website, and also People's World, the other socialist magazine that I feature on this show with some regularity, they are really unusual on the left today, and they highlight a division in the left that I've pointed out on the show before, but that I don't think gets enough attention. And it really is that the woke part of the left, the part that wants to police speech and say, oh, you're not allowed to pretend to be Spanish because of oppression, or, you know, Rachel Dolezal needs to have her life destroyed for pretending to be black and wants to create hierarchies of who's the most oppressed person in the world and so on and so forth. They're not the same as the socialist left. They're not the same as the communist left. They're not the same as the revolutionary left that is really more about economic redistribution. They're more interested in the class war. And people who think of the woke and socialists as the same group, I think, kind of misunderstand the left. And that includes college students who say, I'm woke and I'm a socialist. Those are two different things. And as the World Socialist website, who has impeccable socialist credentials, founded originally by Leon Trotsky — obviously the website wasn't founded by Trotsky, the original publication and organization was founded by Trotsky, that eventually became the World Socialist website. So impeccable socialist credentials, and they recognize that woke stuff has nothing to do with real leftism. And so listen to this take. This is a very interesting take that you're not going to hear in most of the mainstream on this statue. So if you're not familiar, this statue has been in Boston for like 141 years, and it was recently voted to take it down. You can see Lincoln here. For those who are listening to the podcast version of this, there's a Lincoln, and he's got the Emancipation Proclamation in one hand, and he's kind of got his other hand out like he's like bestowing a blessing. And then crouched in front of him, there is a freed slave who's got chains on his wrist, but he's holding the key to his chains. And apparently this is like paternalistic and defensive and so on and so forth. So the article says, on December 29th, city officials removed from downtown Boston a famous statue of Abraham Lincoln and an emancipated slave that has stood for 141 years. This politically reactionary act was the culmination of a campaign, including a petition drive carried out by racialist elements linked to the Democratic Party. So the World Socialist website sets themselves up as opposed to the racialist factions within the Democratic Party. Politics makes for strange bedfellows, and in that case, people who are opposed to racialism, like me, find themselves on the side with socialists who oppose racialism because they think the most important division in society is class, between the capitalist class and the labor class. And the labor class, according to them, transcends race. The transcending race is more important than recognizing or cataloging the various racial oppressions of the past few centuries. So on July 1st, the article says, the Boston Art Commission voted unanimously for the removal of the statue. So upon removal of the monument last Tuesday, the city announced that it will be put into storage pending determination of a new location. The statue in Boston is a copy of the Emancipation Memorial, which is part of the Lincoln Memorial in the United States Capitol in Washington, D.C. So contrary to the claims, to skip down a little bit here, of its racialist detractors, the statue, paid for by subscriptions from former slaves, cannot, by any objective standard, be characterized as racist or demeaning. It depicts the abolition of slavery in the U.S., which Lincoln and over 360,000 Union soldiers paid for in blood. The granite base of the statue is all that is left, and this is where it becomes important. Frederick Douglass, the famous African-American abolitionist and a man who was born a slave, I should add, gave a powerful speech acknowledging Lincoln's greatness at the dedication of the monument in 1876. Now, this brings me to the uplifting thing that I wanted to talk about, and this is from American Greatness, Frederick Douglass's American Identity Politics. I'm actually going to read most of this article, so strap in, folks. This is a good one. And it ties directly to this Lincoln statue and the future of the United States here as we kind of take the opportunity here on January 1st to look forward and kind of ask ourselves, what will the year 2021 contain? And what can we as individuals add to the stream of life in the year of our Lord 2021? So the article says Mark Twain copied a friend's remark into his notebook. Quote, I am not an American. I am the American. That is a claim to be the American, the exemplary or representative American, that very few Americans could plausibly make. Twain himself could. Benjamin Franklin could and did. Abraham Lincoln could but didn't, though admirers made the claim for him. Surely some others could, too. But among all Americans, past or present, no one could make such a claim more compellingly than Frederick Douglass. Like his country, Douglass rose from a low beginning to a great height. Like his country again, he won his freedom in a revolutionary struggle, by his own virtue and against great odds, and he matured into an exemplar of universal liberty, admired the world over. And like his country, finally, Douglass the individual was divided by race. Unlike America, Douglass could hardly think of himself as conceived in liberty. But even in this respect, especially in this respect, he represents a larger American promise. The son of a white slaveholder and a black slave, Douglass became, along with Abraham Lincoln, post-founding America's most important exponent of the natural rights argument summarized in the Declaration of Independence. Pursuant to those same principles, he became America's most prominent representative of the aspiration toward racial integration, reconciliation, and uplift. So the article goes on to explain, and really history vindicates this, that Frederick Douglass, after he escaped slavery, he taught himself to read while he was a slave. He was given the basics by the wife of one of his masters. The master found out that the wife had been teaching him to read, said, by the way, you know it's a felony to teach slaves to read, right? And then ultimately, one thing led to another. Ultimately, Douglass ran away from the South, made it to the North, ended up at abolition meetings. He got up to speak and tell his story. He was an instant favorite because he was a tremendously powerful speaker, a self-educated person. His writing style has influenced writing in the United States. He moved from that kind of overly flowery, hyper-educated 19th century style to something that more closely resembles the way we write today. And as a result, his autobiography, The Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave, is one of the most eminently readable books of the 19th century, not least also because it is an incredibly emotionally powerful read. But Douglass, along with William Lloyd Garrison, who was America's foremost abolitionist in the mid-19th century, initially took the line of argument that said we can have no union with slave owners. We'd rather see the United States split up and let the Confederate States go their own way, then we would be in the same country as them. They were indeed Northern secessionists, you might say. But ultimately, Douglass came around to a different line of thinking. Ultimately, as he recognized, or as he said, the best way to preserve slavery would be to split up the Union and let the Confederate States go their way. That indeed the United States needed to come together to say this does not reflect our values. That you cannot have a society in which all men are created equal, but some of them are slaves. It doesn't make any sense. And so ultimately Douglass came around to a more kind of pro-American way of looking at the question. And ultimately, at the dedication of that statue of Lincoln with the crouched slave freeing himself from his shackles as Lincoln puts his hand on the Emancipation Proclamation, Frederick Douglass spoke at the inauguration of that statue, or the opening of that, unveiling of that statue. And Frederick Douglass, I think, had more credibility than anyone alive today to speak on the subject of race, because he had literally felt the whips and chains of slavery on his own back and his own skin. He had suffered because of who he was, because of the color he was born, in a way that Americans today of any color, of any background, simply cannot imagine. And he felt the statue was fine. And he also felt that America was going to be okay. That we had a lot of issues to wrestle with, but nonetheless, the American spirit was something worth working for and preserving. And that ultimately, despite the many blemishes in our history, and the many blemishes that will no doubt continue to appear as we struggle forth into the future, making mistake after mistake, trying always to live up to the original promises of the United States Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, that ultimately, in each instance, we triumph and move a little bit closer to the realization of those ideals as originally ensconced in our founding documents. And that is the message of hope that I promised yesterday and with which I want to start out the year of 2021. So, in the words of Miss Frizzle from the Magic School Bus, going into 2021 as an American society, as the nation of America, that wonderful multiracial, multicultural mess that we inhabit and call home, let's get messy and make some mistakes. Welcome to 2021. This has been the first episode of the year of Socratic Citizen. I'm Patrick Cunningham. Thank you for watching.